reflexes to their limits, he found it incredibly helpful. It gave him cues at exactly the right time and directed his eyes toward the apex of the turn, freeing up his mind to process everything else that was going on. He left turn four, hammered the accelerator, and cycled up through the gears quickly. The back straight was a long stretch, uphill at first until it passed under a vacant observation bridge, where it went downgrade in a straight line toward turn five. Left 70, off camber. Kurt hit the brakes hard, felt the blood rushing to the front of his face, and swung wide before cutting across the turn. Just like every other lap, he felt the car drifting, pulled toward the fence and the waiting bay by the invisible force of gravity. Since the car went where the eyes focused, he kept his eyes glued to the inner part of the turn. The rest of the lap went smoothly, and Kurt raced through the start finish line with a 9-second lead on the robot car. One down, four laps to go, Kurt said. From the elevated viewing stand in the pit area, Han watched his $10 million robot car chase Kurt around the track. To his chagrin, the second lap was even worse than the first. By the time they crossed the line, Kurt was ahead by more than 10 seconds. He glanced at Gao. There must be something wrong with the car, he said. How is Austin beating it? There's nothing wrong with it, Gao replied. Austin had 5 laps to warm up his tires. Our car is racing on cold rubber. It has less grip in the turns, and the computer is keeping the speed down. By lap 3, we'll be equal footing. We'll catch him by lap 4 and pass him on the front straight. By the end of the race, our car will be 20 seconds ahead of him. It won't even be close. You'd better be right, Han said. I don't like being embarrassed. Take the safety protocols off, just to be sure. Gao looked at his boss questioningly, and then did as he was told. With the flick of a switch, the automated car was instructed to ignore its safe operating parameters, and win at all costs. Chapter 36. From the cockpit of Kurt's car, the third lap seemed to go much like the first two. But by the start of the fourth lap, he could see that the robot car was gaining on him. The glare of its headlights had become constant in his mirrors, 4 diamond-white pinpricks announcing that the hunter was closing in on its prey. The brilliant white lamps did more than aggravate. They were affecting Kurt's night vision, causing his pupils to constrict and limiting his ability to see past the swath of his own headlights. As lap 4 went on, the lights grew closer, and Kurt's driving became less precise. He was a little wide on turns 1 and 2, and caught the rumble strip badly in the chicane. Aggravated with himself, he stomped the gas early and hard coming out of the next turn and almost spun the car out of control. The emotionless computer following him made none of those mistakes, and the gap between them dropped to 4 seconds. Right 30, the navigator said. Kurt iced his own emotions and got back to driving as he had been before. He cut the wheel smoothly, sped through the turn, and rode the gears higher into the red this time before shifting. The robot car continued to close the gap. The two cars thundered down the back straight toward the dangerous curve, the robot car's nose so close to Kurt's back wing that the lights were no longer in Kurt's eyes. It was drafting him now and getting ready to slingshot by. And there was precious little Kurt could do about it. Come on, Kurt said. Get around me if you're going. Left 70, off camber. The turn was coming up fast. Kurt needed to brake. He cut to the inside of the track and hit the brakes. The robot car did the same, but Kurt had hit the brakes earlier than the automated car had planned to. The nose of the robotic vehicle crashed into the back of Kurt's car. Kurt was shoved forward and sent offline. His car slid for a second, but as Kurt adjusted the wheel, the tires regained their grip and the Toyota straightened with a whiplashing snap and stayed online. With his foot to the floor, Kurt cruised around the wide horseshoe at the far end of the track and then onto the front straight once more. The robot car had fallen back after the impact, but was gaining on him again, though not as quickly as it had done the last lap. The impact had damaged its nose and affected its aerodynamics. As far as Kurt could tell, his own car was unhindered. He raced along the front straight, roaring past the pits and then the viewing stand. He stole a glance at Han and his assistant up on the platform. Reckless human drivers, my eye. Up on the platform, Han was almost foaming at the mouth. I told you not to lose this race. Gao was monitoring the telemetry. Nothing I can do about it now. You wanted the safeties off. That's the danger. Pass him, Gao. The car will make another attempt on the back straight, but Austin is putting in his fastest lap yet. He's a quick study. Perhaps we should stop helping him then, Han said. What are you suggesting? Shut off his navigation system. He'll be waiting for the announcement and drive right into the wall, Gao said. He wanted to prove humans can outdrive machines. Let him prove it on his own. Gao took a deep breath. You kill him here, and his government will grow suspicious. Not if it's an accident. Wen told you to keep him alive, Gao argued, to use him as a scapegoat. A wave of fury erupted from Han. He grabbed Gao by the collar. Do as I say. Shut off the navigation. Released from Han's grasp, Gao looked out over the track. Austin was making his way through the chicane and toward turn four. He waited a few seconds, and then switched the relay to the off position. Kurt knew Han's car might try to take him out again, but he never considered stopping the race. He was determined to beat Han now more than ever. He raced hard through the familiar turns on the front side of the track, operating with a mix of patience and restrained aggression. His orange and white Toyota carved a perfect line this time, and it flew up the hill at a furious pace. Right fort, the navigator said, the announcement oddly clipped in the middle. Kurt dove into the turn, let the inside wheels hit the rumble strip to help him through it, and left the apex of the curve at nearly full speed. Hitting the back straight, he spun the engine to its limits, letting the tachometer wind into the red as he blazed through the night. The orange and white strips on the side of the track flew by at a dizzying pace. The lights shimmered on Nagasaki Bay, and the robot car came on from behind, tracking him down and closing in with each fraction of a second. Kurt flashed beneath the vacant bridge and bore down on the notorious Turn 5. The engine screamed in a full wail behind him. His fingers were light on the steering wheel, his foot poised to switch from accelerator to brake at the first instant of the navigator's announcement. It took only a fraction of a second for Kurt to realize it wasn't coming. His eyes spotted the skid marks from the earlier lap, his mind calculating instantly that he was going too fast and getting too close. He slammed on the brakes. The anti-lock system prevented a full skid, but an eruption of blue tire smoke filled the track. The harness dug into Kurt's shoulders and he grunted as he turned the wheel, cutting it harder and keeping his foot on the brake. His Toyota slowed rapidly, but went into a drift. The tire smoke billowed like a bomb had gone off, and the wall loomed. With no other choice, Kurt let up on the brakes and hit the accelerator to get some control back. The car continued to skid but stayed on the ground. The rubber finally grabbed and the vehicle shot forward toward the inside of the track. It raced onto the infield, nearly clipping the robot car as it flew past him, traveling headlong into the cloud of smoke. With its sensors affected by the smoke and its safeties turned off, the automated car waited too long to begin applying its own brakes. It shot through the smoke cloud, skidded into the turn, and banged the outside wall. The carbon fiber body panels on the right side splintered and flew in all directions. The wing was ripped off the back end. It went flying over the wall like a tomahawk, slicing into the water of Nagasaki Bay. The car itself careened off the wall and slid onto a gravel trap, where it stopped. Kurt had already come to a stop on the grass of the infield. He was safe and sound and angled just about perfectly to view the last few seconds of the automated car's wipeout. He saw it come to a stop on the gravel, two of its headlights blown out, The other two pointed toward the track. Just when it looked to Kurt like the race would be called a draw, the wheels on the robot car spun, and it began grinding its way out of the gravel trap and back onto the course. "Oh, I don't think so," Kurt said. He fired up his own engine, put the car into gear, and punched the gas. The start was slow and sloppy, tearing up 70 yards of turf before he got the nose pointed in the right direction. One look told Kurt there was no way he could catch the robot car by getting back on the track and chasing it around the long horseshoe turn. So he took a shortcut and drove straight across the infield, heading for the other side. Angling for the finish line, he stole a glance across the track. Hans' car was picking up speed but losing parts along the way. They were heading for the same spot from different directions. A collision was imminent. Kurt kept the gas pedal down, merged onto the front straight, and cut across the finish line on a diagonal angle. The robot car, or what was left of it, crossed the line half a second later. Locking up the brakes once more, Kurt skidded to a stop. The robot car slowed with far greater control and stopped 100 feet down the track. Kurt threw open the door, punched the quick release on his harness, and stepped from the car. As Akiko ran up to him, he pulled off his helmet and the fireproof hood. Meanwhile, several of Han's people rushed over to the ruined prototype that had come in second. "Are you all right?" Akiko asked. "Never better," he said, though he was drenched in sweat and smelled like burnt rubber. "I can't believe you won," she said, grabbing his hands. "You really are mad." "I don't like to lose," Kurt said. He held up a single finger. "Humans, 1. Robots, 0. Han and his assistant came down from the viewing platform, looking far less excited. "You haven't won anything," Han insisted. "You cheated. You cut across the infield."
"And you said first one across the finish line wins," Kurt replied. "I don't recall any conditions about how we were supposed to get there."
Han pursed his lips, looking angrily at Kurt. "This mess doesn't prove anything."
Kurt grinned wickedly. "I disagree. It proves robots can be beaten, and that humans aren't the only dangerous outside forces."
Han bristled at Kurt using his own words against him, but there was nothing he could say to refute it. A chime toned on Gao's medallion, and he checked a message on the screen. "Dinner is ready, if anyone is still interested in eating."
Han glowered beside his assistant. He seemed to have lost his appetite. Gao looked like he wanted to be anywhere but there. Akiko tensed, her free hand inching toward the hidden knife beneath her sleeve. Only Kurt was all smiles.
"I'm famished," he said with a grin. "Racing works up quite an appetite."
Chapter 37 Joe was parked at a scenic overlook on the switchback road that led up into the mountains. From there he enjoyed a commanding view of Nagasaki Harbor, the waterfront, and the CNR factory that occupied a large section of it. He set a camera with a powerful zoom lens on a tripod and carried a pair of high-powered military-grade binoculars as a backup. Watching Han's production facility in this way, he'd seen Kurt and Akiko park and enter the building. He'd even caught part of the race on the test track behind the factory. He was glad to see Kurt walk away from the crash unscathed. Most men would have had enough at that point, but Joe knew his friend too well to expect Kurt to call it a night. With the race over and events in a lull, Joe bit into a rather tasteless sandwich he'd purchased from a vending machine. "Just my luck," he said to himself. "Stranded alone on a cliff while Kurt goes to dinner with a beautiful woman and races a million-dollar sports car." Leaning against the fender of the Skyline GTR, he put the sandwich down and lifted the binoculars to his eyes. Focusing them with a light touch, he scanned the area around the factory. Aside from the race, there had been no movement whatsoever. Kurt's rental car sat alone and undisturbed in the parking lot. The grounds themselves remained quiet. Joe hadn't even seen a security patrol. But then China Nippon Robotics probably used automated systems instead of humans, making slow and obvious rounds. Joe lowered the binoculars and checked his watch. It was just past 10 o'clock. Kurt had insisted he and Akiko would return by midnight, no matter what. If they hadn't reappeared by then, it was up to Joe to get them help. Thinking that was a likely possibility, Joe had put in a call to Superintendent Nagano. He'd been told the superintendent was in the field on an assignment and would be out of reach until he returned. There was something odd in the assistant's voice. Joe wanted to chalk it up to translating the words to English, but couldn't shake the feeling that it was something more. Regardless, he was ready with Plan B, a trunkload of industrialized fireworks that he'd launch into the complex as he called the Nagasaki Fire Department for help. It was a crude idea, but it would work. These were no sparklers Joe was going to set off. He had bottle rockets the size of mortar rounds, starburst shells and spinners that he could land on the roof of the factory, where they would flare green, red, and white, while pumping out huge volumes of smoke. And with fumes and fire pouring from the roof of the factory, Han's personnel would be unable to turn the fire department away. Joe would rush in right alongside them. He hoped it wouldn't come to that, but experience had taught him otherwise. "Come on, Kurt," he said to himself. "This isn't the night to linger over drinks." Lowering the binoculars, Joe caught sight of something new, a dark sedan moving down the road toward the factory. Retraining the binoculars on the car, Joe tracked it as it passed under a streetlight and turned toward a loading zone around the side. Joe hopped up and moved to a spot where he could see the loading zone more clearly. The sedan pulled up to the dock. A man got out and climbed up on the loading platform. He rang the buzzer and, without waiting for an answer, began to pound his fist on the back door. An overhead light came on, illuminating the man, but all Joe could see was his back. The door opened. A security guard appeared and words were exchanged. It seemed like a heated discussion. The security guard went back inside and the angry fellow waited impatiently. "Turn around," Joe whispered. "What have you got to lose?" The man stood his ground, and Joe took the moment to grab the camera tripod and bring it to his new vantage point. By the time he'd set it up and focused, the door was open again. This time, Han appeared. He walked out to the parked sedan. The trunk was opened, and Han reached in to retrieve a long wooden case. He rested the case on the roof of the car and opened it. Joe focused as finely as he could. In the case was a shimmering sword. "Strange hour of the night to be buying collectibles," Joe whispered. An approving nod came from Han, and the case was folded shut. Joe expected he would lose any chance to ID the driver in a moment. He edged closer to the cliff, but could not change the angle enough to see the face. Then he noticed a large convex mirror stationed on the edge of the dock. Every loading zone had one, placed there to help the drivers back in without hitting the dock. Joe turned the camera toward the mirror, zoomed in as far as it would go, and refocused. The magnification was so high that the slightest bump made the image blur, so Joe took his hands off the camera and watched the glowing screen. The focus tightened, and Joe recognized the driver. Ushioni. To his surprise, Joe noticed a passenger slumped over against the window of the car as if sleeping. Recognition came to him in a flash. Superintendent Nagano. No wonder he wasn't at his office and his assistant sounded concerned. He was lying on his side in the back of Ushioni's car with a length of white tape stretched across his mouth. Movement began in earnest now. Other swords were displayed, some wrapped in leather. Others were in additional wooden boxes. A leather-bound book was produced. Han kept this and offered an approving nod. He waved his hand. The entry gate was drawn back, and Ushioni climbed back into the car and drove through. Chapter 38 Kurt was in the garage washroom, getting dressed and making himself presentable. 10 laps in the hot box of a race car had drenched him in sweat. He He was back in his own clothes and splashing water on his face when his phone began to buzz. He shook the water from his hands, dried his face with a towel, and grabbed the phone. It was Joe.
"I hate to interrupt the fun," Joe said, "but you've got a party crasher. Ushioni just pulled up to the back gate."
Kurt didn't bother asking Joe if he was sure. He wouldn't have made the call if there was any doubt. So Nagano wasn't able to track him down.
"Wish that was the case," Joe said, "but it looks like the hunter got taken down by the hunted. I saw Nagano in the back of the sedan, mouth taped, hands tied."
"Is he alive?"
"Can't tell. He wasn't moving."
Kurt held the phone against his chin as he pulled on his dinner jacket. "Where's the car now?"
"It pulled through the gate and parked just beyond the loading zone by the secondary building."
"How do I get there?"
"You need to get to the southwest corner of the building you're in now."
Kurt needed to create a distraction. He had an idea that would dovetail nicely with the tools Joe had at his disposal. "I'm going to make a run for it. Get yourself into position. If they leave the building, you follow them. If they stay, give me 2 minutes and then start the fireworks."
"I figured you might want some help," Joe said. "I'm setting up the launch tray now."
2 minutes, Kurt repeated. "Not a second more." Joe confirmed and hung up. Kurt put the phone in his pocket, straightened his cuffs, and walked out of the washroom. Akiko waited outside chatting quietly with Gao. Walter Hahn was nowhere in sight.
"Are we still on for dinner?"
"I'll take you to the dining room," Gao said. "Mr. Hahn will join you shortly."
Kurt nodded and took Akiko by the hand.
"Lead on."
Gao took them across the garage toward the inner doors. Kurt spent every second scanning for the items he needed. Workbenches surrounded them. Tool chests filled with every implement known to man covered an entire wall. But Kurt was looking for the simplest of items. Spotting what he wanted, he squeezed Akiko's hand ever so slightly. She looked over at him. He nodded toward Gao. Her eyes widened. He held up one hand. "Wait." They reached the inner door. Gao pulled out his key card and held it to the sensor. The light on the door went green and the bolt disengaged with an audible click. Before he could pass through it, Kurt clubbed him between the neck and the shoulder with a knife hand strike. The blow landed hard on Gao's suprascapular nerve, rendered the right side of his body numb and dropped him to the floor in a daze. A right cross to the jaw put him down for the count. "He's out cold," Kurt said, checking on him and grabbing the key card. "Find something to tie his hands with." She grabbed an electrical cord and began binding Gao.
"What are we doing?" she asked. "You know they're watching. There are cameras everywhere in here."
"Which means we have to move fast."
Kurt ran to one of the workbenches. Oily rags filled the garbage bin on one side. Spray cans of WD-40 stood nearby. "Spray the WD-40 into that pile of rags and keep spraying," he told her. All he needed was a spark. He found it with the battery cart they'd used to start the race cars. While she soaked the rags with the lubricant, he wheeled the cart over to the workbench, switched it on, and scraped the terminals against each other. Sparks shot in all directions.
"Are you about to do what I think you're about to do?"
"They burned you and Kenzo out," he said. "Now we're going to return the favor." Stepping around her, Kurt brought the cables up and placed them in line with the mist blasting from the can. A single touch released a new wave of sparks, and the spray can was transformed into a miniature flamethrower. Akiko held the nozzle open for several seconds before releasing it. By then, the garbage bin full of cotton rags had become a burning cauldron. Kurt shoved it beneath a workbench so that it wouldn't go out when the sprinklers came on. Akiko tossed the can of WD-40 inside for good measure.
"Let's go," he said, rushing to the door.
"Where are we going?"
she asked. "To the southwest corner of the building," he said. "Joe saw a van pull up with Superintendent Nagano inside. Let's just say he didn't come here of his own volition." Kurt used the key card to open the door, smashed the glass of a fire panel with his elbow and pulled the alarm handle. Lights began to flash, and the alarm began wailing.
"Wait," Akiko said. She dashed back into the garage. "Come on," Kurt shouted. "We don't have time."
She returned seconds later, dragging the unconscious body of Gao behind her.
He would have been fine, Kurt said. This place isn't going to burn up like your old castle.
I wasn't saving him, she said. We need a doorstop if we want to cause any real trouble.
She wedged him between the door and the wall, keeping it open and allowing the hall to fill with smoke.
A helpful touch, Kurt said. Let's go.
They were off and running, heading down the hall to the southwest. At the end of the hall, Kurt found a locked fire door, but Gao's keycard opened it. They made it through what had to be a design room, filled with scale models and computers, and then found an elevator lobby with doors on three sides, plus the one they'd come through. Kurt rushed to the farthest door and opened it with the keycard. He saw only offices and a conference room. He turned to see Akiko waving him over. She'd found an emergency escape plan plastered to the wall. It showed the entire floor plan.
Three cheers for the Japanese version of OSHA, Kurt said.
Akiko was looking out into the room and rechecking the plan.
It's got to be that one.
They ran to the door on their right, opened it, and found a long hall that led along the front of the building. Running through it, Kurt saw the first of many flares and phosphorus explosions raining down on the lawn outside.
Rocket's red glare, he said, right on time.
Chapter 39 Joe had launched exactly half of his fireworks at Han's building when he called the fire department. Using the phonetic translation Akiko had worked out for him in advance, he told them the CNR factory was exploding and burning. At least that's what he hoped he was telling them. He repeated it twice and then hung up. Grabbing the second set of launch tubes, he loaded more of the monster-sized bottle rockets and angled them to fire downward and onto the roof ahead of him instead of up into the sky. With the press of a button, he lit them off. The launch filled the overlook with a swirling cloud of gray smoke. Through it, Joe saw red, white, and purple explosions right above the building. Another shell, designed to flare in a horsetail effect, hit the roof and spread out blazing golden embers in all directions. He listened to reverberating booms and the sound of fire engines coming from the outskirts of town.
That should do it, Joe said to himself.
He got up, tossed the camera and the binoculars into the back of the skyline, and climbed into the driver's seat. The sirens were growing louder by the moment. He could see the flashing lights coming down the main road a mile or two from the factory, but it was another sound that got his attention. He turned back toward the factory and noticed lights descending toward it from Nagasaki Bay. Amid all the chaos, a helicopter was coming in for a landing. Joe turned the key, put the skyline in gear and spun the tires, pulling off the dirt and out onto the road. If Han's people took Nagano out of there in a helicopter, he would never be seen again. Gao had already come around by the time Han and three members of the security team reached him. Smoke was pouring into the hall through the open door to the garage. The sprinklers were blasting at full pressure, but the fire had been hidden so well it wasn't being doused.
"Untie him," Han ordered one of the men, "and get someone in there to put out that damned fire."
"What happened?" Gao asked groggily.
"What do you think happened?" Han snapped. "Austin and the woman jumped you and set the place on fire."
By now, the guard had untied Gao's hands and propped him up. Gao rubbed at his wrists, then his neck.
"Maybe they realized I was taking video of them."
Han put his hand on the medallion around Gao's neck. It was undamaged. The high-tech computer glasses he'd been wearing lay on the floor a few feet away.
"If they were upset about you recording them, they wouldn't have left all your cameras behind. This is an act of desperation, a fire to bring the authorities into the building, an incident to put a spotlight of attention on us. It won't matter. In fact, it will be more evidence to use against them later. Did you get enough video?"
Gao nodded. "We have video, voice recordings, movement analysis, everything we need to construct a replica."
"Good," Han said. "There's a helicopter on the way in. Get back to the island and get working on them immediately."
"Them? You want more than one?"
Oni has brought us a gift. The policeman who helped Austin back in Tokyo. I want a replica of him also. It will make it that much more difficult for the authorities to cause us trouble when we make our move.
Kurt and Akiko made it to the warehouse. The loading bay waited just beyond. Using Gao's keycard, Kurt opened the last door. A stairwell led down to the floor where towers of wooden crates and machinery loomed like a miniature city. Several vehicles sat at the far end.
We're going to need a way out of this once we get Nagano, Kurt said. See if you can find the keys to one of those cars or trucks.
If not, I can hotwire one, Akiko said.
Good, Kurt said. If we have a choice, something sturdy enough to break down metal gates and brick walls would be nice.
I'll do my best, Akiko said.
I probably don't have to tell you this after what we've seen, but watch out for the automated equipment. If Han can use machines to storm an armed compound, he can turn anything with batteries and cameras into a whistleblower, or worse.
Akiko nodded and moved off, traveling swift and silent. Kurt went the other direction, heading for the back door. He pressed up against it and opened it a crack. He saw Ushione bossing around a group of Han's men. He was barking orders as the men went to work emptying the sedan. First, they removed some long wooden boxes, then other items wrapped in leather. They placed the boxes on a cart with great care, before moving back to the car and dragging out Superintendent Nagano with far less caution. Nagano sagged to the ground as he was pulled out of the sedan, which Kurt noticed was sporting government plates. One of the men shouted at Nagano. A second man kicked him as they tried to force him to stand on his own. At least he was alive. Kurt hoped some of them would leave with the treasure they had, but they stuck together, and Kurt soon saw why. A helicopter was descending toward a concrete swath just beyond where they stood. 5-1. Wonderful odds. Kurt looked around for a way to even the playing field and settled on using a forklift. Starting the electrical vehicle was easy, driving it a little more difficult. But he didn't need to be as precise as he'd been out on the racetrack. He backed up, pivoted, and sped forward, raising the arms of the forklift like a pair of spears. He drove around and out through an open bay door, and from there came flying around the edge, gunning for Ushione. The demon saw him at the last second and dove out of the way. Two of his men weren't so lucky. The forklift slammed them like a battering ram. Luckily, they weren't skewered. Kurt immediately pulled backward and spun to the right. The three-wheeled vehicle pivoted with surprising swiftness, and the raised forks took out another of Han's men, knocking him out of the way, cracking several ribs in the process. Gunfire rang out before Kurt could do anything else. Ricochets and near misses forced him off the forklift. He dove to the ground and took cover. By the time he looked up, Han's remaining guard was dragging Nagano to the helipad. Kurt rose up, intending to give chase, but Ushione blocked the way. Instead of a gun, Oni held a gleaming katana sword. He waved the sword toward Kurt. To the samurai, a blade was worthless if it couldn't cut a man in half with a single swing. They tested their weapons on captives and criminals. I'm going to test this one on you. He stepped forward and swung at a diagonal angle. Kurt jumped behind the stationary forklift and the blade slammed against the protective cage. Looking for any kind of weapon to defend himself with, Kurt grabbed a pry bar from the side of the forklift. That won't help you, Oni said. He lunged forward again, swinging for Kurt's head. Kurt ducked and held the pry bar up at the same time. It deflected the blade just enough to save him. But the sword came back from the other direction and knocked the bar from Kurt's hand. A third swing forced Kurt to dive away once more. He rolled and came up bleeding. His suit was slashed, his shirt was sliced, and there was blood oozing from a line on the back of his arm. The tip of the blade had made so fine a cut, Kurt barely felt it. The next one will take your head, Oni insisted. Kurt didn't doubt it, but the sound of fire engines closing in and of the helicopter landing gave him hope.
If I were you, I'd get out of here. You'll never get to spend Han's money if you're serving life in prison.
Kurt's words brought the fury of the demon down on him. The sword came hard once more. Kurt moved to the side, keeping the forklift between him and Oni. Oni went one way, Kurt went the other. It was an effective defense if reinforcements showed up. But Kurt needed an offense. Now.
He lunged for the controls, reaching into the cage, turning the key and spinning the small wheel. The forklift jerked to the side and spun randomly. Oni was knocked backward, but more of Han's men were closing in.
Kurt had no choice. He jumped onto the forklift and threw it into reverse, speeding away from Oni and the men as the helicopter touched down. He raced back into the warehouse, found himself surrounded, but was bought freedom when Akiko came crashing through the stacks of equipment and crates in a 10-wheeled truck.
As Han's men took cover from the avalanche, Kurt climbed into the truck and Akiko backed out of the warehouse. She drove across the lot, blasted her way through the gate, and turned down the access road as the fire trucks came racing up it.
"Keep going," he said. "Don't stop for anything, not even the police."
As she drove, Kurt got on the phone.
"Joe, where are you? They took Nagano in the helicopter."
"I saw that," Joe replied. "I'm trying to follow it and get a tail number, but I'm running out of road."
"Where are they headed?"
"Southwest, along the bay."
Joe drove with skills that would have matched Kurt out on the racetrack, but he had to deal with real-world issues. Other cars, potholes, and pedestrians. He swerved around a slow-moving bus, lost sight of the helicopter as it went behind the trees, and then found it again as the view opened up. He came to a one-way road, ignored the rules of traffic, and followed it downhill. By the way it sloped, he knew he was heading for the shoreline. A building blocked his view. Seconds later, a small car almost hit him head-on. Horns blared, and Joe drove into the gutter, where he avoided taking out a fire hydrant. He pulled back onto a two-way street as soon as he could.
"Where'd you go?" he said, craning his neck around and looking for the fleeing helicopter.
Finally, he saw it again, farther out over the water. It was definitely heading out to sea. He found another street, sped up again, and then slammed on the brakes as his lights reflected off a sign at the end of the road. The tires screeched, and the Skyline GTR slid to a stop inches from a 50-foot drop. Joe got out of the car and raised the binoculars. He tracked the helicopter for another 30 seconds, and then its lights went out, and it vanished in the night sky.
Chapter 40. Washington, D.C. The Earth Studies Lab filled the basement of the main NUMA building in Washington, D.C. It was located down there for purely practical reasons. Being an experimental facility, it took up a lot of space and contained bulky equipment, including large tanks filled with water, sand, clay, and various other soils. Conducting tsunami studies, seismic analyses, and erosion experiments meant that sections of the lab were subjected to artificial earthquakes, weather, and flooding, and no one wanted overflow from the latest rogue wave simulation dripping down through the ceiling above them. As Rudy Gunn stepped from the elevator and onto the laboratory floor, he was careful to look for puddles. He found none and made his way to the geology department, where two of NUMA's best had been working through the night and into the morning. He arrived first at the desk of Robert Henley. Henley was one of the marine geologists who worked under Paul. Thin and ghostly pale, Henley wore his blonde hair long and his beard even longer. It gave him the look of an emaciated Nordic prince.
"Morning, Henley."
"Is it?"
Henley asked.
"I'd hoped it was still dark outside."
"Sun's just coming up. I was glad to get your message when I arrived. So you and Priya have something to show me."
"We think we know where the influx of water is coming from."
"That's good news," Rudy said. Henley looked grim.
"You'd better hold off on that until you hear the details," he said. "I'll let Priya explain. It was her theory that we've been following."
Henley reached over to an intercom button and pressed it.
"Rudy's here," he said. "Ready to tell him what we've found?"
"Be right there," an English voice replied.
As Henley straightened some papers on his desk, Rudy caught sight of Priya Kashmir approaching. Priya was Indian, born in Mumbai, but had grown up in London. She'd spent a year at Oxford before transferring to MIT. She had dark eyes, high cheekbones, and full lips. Her mahogany-colored hair was cut to shoulder length at the moment, while a tiny diamond stud rested on the right side of her nose where she'd recently had it pierced. It would have been easy to describe her as beautiful. Easy, and a disservice. While she had classic features and an alluring smile, her beauty was secondary to her intellect, and perhaps third in comparison to her determination. Priya had graduated in the top of her class at MIT while building a foundation to bring learning material to poor children in rural India. She'd been quite an athlete as well, running track and swimming competitively while finishing her master's. Rudy had hired her after a single interview, and she'd been several weeks from joining NUMA when a terrible car crash had damaged her spine. 5 surgeries and 6 months of painful rehabilitation had been unable to restore her mobility, though she had regained some feeling in her toes, and that gave her hope. Given the choice to come aboard or continue her rehab, she'd taken Rudy's offer to start working, and had spent most of her time in Hiram Yeager's computer lab. She'd shown a great ability to focus on things others overlooked, and for that reason, Rudy had assigned her to work with the geology team in Paul's absence. She came around the corner, propelling herself forward in a compact wheelchair. It was a product of her own design, modeled after the athletic wheelchairs used in sporting activities, and moved by her own strength instead of a battery pack. She rolled up to Rudy and Henley, wearing a sleeveless gray top and blue jeans. Henley couldn't take his eyes off her, something Priya did not miss. "What are you staring at, Robert?" "Sorry," Henley said. "I can't decide what I'm more envious of, your perfect tan or your muscular arms." Priya broke into a surprised smile. "Nicest compliment I've heard in ages. The tan comes from Mum and Dad. The biceps are all mine. Push yourself around in one of these for a while, and you'll be buff before you know it." "I'd never make it out of the room," Henley said. "My arms are like wet noodles." Rudy cleared his throat and got everyone's attention. "I understand you two have found something?" "Yes," Priya said, "but I'm not certain it will be welcome news." "I warned him," Henley added. "Feelings can wait," Rudy said. "We need answers. What have you got?" Priya moved to a new position. "It starts with what we haven't found. The first possibility was a subsurface aquifer that the Chinese had ruptured. It would have to be incredibly large and under massive pressure to cause the geyser field that Paul and Gamay recorded. Hard to hide such a thing. We looked at a pair of sub-bottom profiling studies done by the Japanese. The coverage area doesn't extend much into the Chinese side, but nothing in the study indicates a major pool of pressurized water beneath the continental shelf. So, we went deeper." Henley took it from there. "We borrowed some data from an oil exploration company that charted the region several years ago. Before the price of oil crashed, everyone was looking for deep water wells. This company took it to an extreme. They were looking for hydrocarbon deposits several miles below the seabed, the kind that can't be extracted profitably unless the price of oil is through the roof. $150 a barrel or more." "And?" "No oil," Henley said. "Only a few small natural gas deposits on the Chinese side." "What about water?" Rudy asked. "No water either, but they did find a complex series of vertical fractures running deep into the crust, well beyond the range of the survey." "Vertical fractures?" "Of a type I've never seen before," Henley admitted. "Nothing in the geology database matches them. It's like the survey found a new type of rock. Interesting in its own right, but not an ocean of fresh water." "That made us look even deeper," Priya said, "and it got me thinking about ways to study what was down there without needing to send an ROV to the bottom. We settled on looking for Kenzo's Z-waves, and we found them. Apparently some of the more advanced seismic monitoring stations are equipped to detect them,
but the computer programs they run on have been filtering the data out.
Why?
Because the pattern they produce is identical to the signal generated by a deep earth mining system using high-intensity sound waves.
Mining?
Priya nodded. So that's what the Chinese have been doing down there.
So it appears, Priya said. But I'm afraid that's not the most interesting or stunning news. Once we got a hold of the raw, unfiltered data and ran it through a program that Robert designed, we were able to determine the depth and orientation of the Z-waves. What we found was incredible. The Z-waves are propagating vertically, down into the crust and back up.
How deep do they go? Rudy asked.
Henley answered, through the crust and the upper mantle, into an area known as the transition zone, at least 200 miles below the surface. At the bottom of the transition zone, the Z-waves are reflected back off the denser rock and bounced back up to the surface, creating a harmonic vibration on the way in and the way out. And that tremor is wreaking havoc on a particular type of mineral within the transition zone.
What kind of mineral?
Ever heard of ringwoodite?
Ringwoodite? Rudy shook his head.
No. It's a crystalline mineral similar to olivine that forms only under intense pressure. It's found deep in the transition zone beneath the upper mantle. In 2014, geologists studying a diamond that had been brought to the surface by a volcanic eruption discovered a sample of ringwoodite trapped within it. To their surprise, the strange mineral was not alone. It was concealing a special form of water.
Priya finished for him.
This led to another study, one to determine how much ringwoodite was present in the mantle and how much of that contained water. The teams that worked on it used seismic activity as their ultrasound generators and measured the results over a period of months. They discovered that the entire transition zone, 150 miles thick, is permeated with ringwoodite, and most of that is trapping water. It's normally held there under the intense pressure, capped by the rock layers above. Something like carbonated water in a soda bottle. But the Chinese mining effort has fractured the rock all the way down to the transition zone, breaking the cap and releasing the pressure.
And thus releasing the water, Rudy said, grasping the rest of the argument, which is forcing its way up through the crust under all that pressure.
That would explain the field of geysers we've seen, and it might give us a clue how to stop it or how bad it's going to get.
I'm not sure why you're so glum. I don't consider this bad news at all.
Perhaps you should, Henley said. This isn't an oil well that can be capped or even an underground lake that will spew forth for a while and then dry up. The transition zone contains a vast amount of water. An almost unfathomable amount, to use a nautical term.
I need numbers, Rudy said. Just how much water are we talking about?
3 or 4 times the amount in all the world's oceans, rivers, lakes, and ice caps combined. If it all came to the surface, the landmass of the Earth would be completely submerged. This would be a water-covered planet, a shimmering blue ball without a single island. Even the tip of Mount Everest, the highest point on Earth, would be submerged beneath 12,000 feet of water.
Rudy didn't react to the statement offhand. He knew Henley was given to predictions of destruction, all part of his Hamlet-like nature. But the man was a first-rate scientist. He didn't twist the numbers. He just tended to focus on the worst possible outcome.
Priya, on the other hand, was the eternal optimist. It was in her nature to believe things were never as bad as they looked, and that nothing couldn't be overcome. Rudy turned her way.
How likely is that to happen?
Highly unlikely, Priya said with a glance toward Henley. But if just 5% of the water trapped inside the transition layer is forced to the surface, sea levels will rise by 2,000 feet.
2,000 feet, Rudy said.
Priya nodded.
And how likely is a 5% discharge from this layer of rock?
She shrugged.
Impossible to say. No one's ever seen this before. We don't know exactly what is happening. All we know is, It's getting worse. The rise in the sea level has accelerated in the last 6 months, again in the last 90 days, and once again in the last 5 weeks. As for predictions, the basic math is simple. A 5% discharge is far more likely than a 10% surge. 4% is more likely still. 3, 2, 1? Take your pick. A 1% discharge is exponentially more probable than a 5% release. But even at that level, even if just 1 drop in 100 is forced out of the transition layer, the sea level will still rise 400 feet. Henley chimed in with more doom and gloom. You'd lose every major coastal city in the world, half the landmass of South America, most of Northern Europe, large swaths of America, especially in the south and along both urban coasts. Not to mention the most densely populated swaths of Asia and India. 2 billion people would be forced to relocate. But there will be nowhere to put them and nothing to feed them, even if they could find somewhere to call their own. And as if that's not bad enough, Rudy cut him off. He didn't need Henley launching into depressing detail about what would happen to humanity. He needed them to find a way to stop it. Is there a way for us to put a halt to this upwelling? We can't be sure, Priya said. We'd have a much better idea of what's possible if we knew exactly what the Chinese did down there. But there is a possibility that they've released something that can't be put back in the bottle. Rudy studied her face. Determination was mixed with a sense of grim acknowledgement. Better than any of them, Priya knew there were forces that human effort and engineering just couldn't overcome. Put all the data into a report, Rudy said. In fact, give me 2 reports. One with all the technical data and a simpler version that lay people and politicians can understand. I'll need them both within the hour. Are you going to go public with it? Priya asked. No, Rudy said. Something far more dangerous. I'm going to send the information to China. Chapter 41 Nagasaki. Kurt stared at the map with great intensity, as if by force of will he could make it reveal the destination of Han's helicopter. The helicopter was traveling on this course, Joe said, using the mouse to draw a line on the screen. It flew right over this building and out over the harbor in this direction. The line ran to the southwest. Maybe they're taking him to China, Akiko suggested. Odd course to take if they were, Kurt said. Shanghai is the nearest city and most likely destination, and that's due west. Too far away, Joe said. That was a small helicopter. Short-range model. Shanghai is more than 500 miles away. It couldn't reach the Chinese mainland from here. Not in one hop. What about refueling? Kurt asked. Joe sat back. I didn't see anything to suggest it could refuel in midair, but that doesn't rule out landing on a ship. That's what I was thinking, Kurt said, which is why I brought up the ship tracker. At the touch of a button, the position and direction of every ship within 100 miles of Nagasaki Harbor appeared on the screen. The map went out 100 miles and could be expanded farther if needed, but the problem became apparent rather quickly. There must be hundreds of ships out there, Akiko noted. Doesn't Han own a yacht? Joe asked. Kurt looked it up online. 3, actually. Seems like a good place to start. Kurt typed the identification numbers of Han's yachts into the search window, requesting locations. He was given a worldwide map. 1 yacht is in Monaco, 1 docked in Shanghai, and 3rd is undergoing upgrades in Italy. We can rule out his yachts, Joe said. Kurt brought the original screen back up. Typing quickly, he set a new search in place, eliminating all ships under 5,000 tons and deleting all vessels incapable of handling a helicopter. That brings us down to 49 ships in a 100-mile radius. We can't search 49 ships. We can rule out some of them by nationality, Kurt said, continuing to type. Assuming Han wouldn't land on an American or European-flagged vessel cuts the number to 26. How many of them along that course line? Joe asked. Kurt tapped the keyboard and brought up Joe's line once again.
None, he said, surprised. The closest ship is 14 miles to the north and is headed into Nagasaki Harbor, not out to sea. The helicopter could have changed course, Akiko said. After all, it did shut off its lights. Kurt looked at Joe. That seem odd to you? Not if he didn't want to be watched, Joe said. The only way I could track him was by the position lights. As soon as those lights went off, that bird literally vanished in the sky. But how could Han or the pilot know you were following them? Kurt said. Joe tilted his head. You're right. They couldn't possibly know. So why shut off their lights at all? Kurt had an idea. How high were they? Low, Joe said. Less than 1,000 feet. Were they climbing? Not that I could tell. More like they were flying straight and level. Kurt turned back to the map. You have a theory? Joe asked. Kurt nodded. He zoomed back in on the course line. I think they flew low to stay off Nagasaki radar, and they went dark not because they thought you were watching, but because they didn't want anyone to watch. And the only reason to fly like that is if you were going to touch down in sight of the mainland, and you didn't want anyone to see you do it. Kurt was looking for an island, not a ship. But there was no shortage of those, either. Gunkanjima, Ikiko said. Kurt and Joe turned her way. Battleship Island, she explained. Its real name is Hashima. It sits off the coast a few miles. The island was a coal mine. At one point, thousands of workers lived there, miners and their families. The island became so built up, with concrete buildings and seawalls, that it resembled a fortress guarding the approach to the city. That's how it got the nickname. She pointed to the island on Kurt's computer screen. It was 16 miles downrange from Han's factory, but because the peninsula ran that way, the island was only a few miles off the coast. Kurt had heard of Hashima. It was a crumbling relic of a bygone era, often listed as one of the world's most haunting abandoned places. I thought they'd turned that island into a tourist trap. They did, Akiko said. It was very popular until about a year ago. But then high levels of asbestos, arsenic, and other poisons were discovered in the soil and the buildings. The tourists roaming through the city were stirring it up and breathing it in. Kurt pulled up an article on the mysterious island. The federal government shut it down 11 months ago, 3 weeks after Han and CNR broke ground on the new factory. Something tells me that's not a coincidence. Coincidence is reserved for the trustworthy, Joe said. Everyone else must live under a cloud of suspicion. Kurt double-checked the flight path as Joe had recalled it. It went almost directly at Hashima Island, but... There are other islands along the flight path, Kurt noted. Takashima and Nakanoshima. Takashima is built up and populated, Akiko told him. There's a museum on the island, along with small hotels and large homes. Hard to land a helicopter there without disturbing the neighbors, Joe said. Nakanoshima Island isn't much more than a rocky outcropping, she added. There's not even a good spot to land. Looking over the satellite image, Kurt agreed. If they're out there, they landed on Battleship Island. The fact that it was closed to the public shortly after Han arrived seals it for me, Joe said. But why bother with an island lair at all? He's got a sprawling, well-defended factory right here. Because he has something to hide, Kurt said. Something he couldn't risk being discovered during a Japanese safety inspection, or by intrusive foreigners like us. We could contact the authorities, Akiko said. Kurt shook his head. A dead end. Han has friends in high places around here, or he wouldn't have gotten the island closed in the first place. All we'd accomplish is tipping our hand. They'd hide whatever they're up to and feed Nagano to the sharks. We're the superintendent's only hope for rescue. And that means we have to get ourselves onto that island, and fast. Chapter 42 Nagasaki Bay 2 hours later, Kurt, Joe, and Akiko were moving across Nagasaki Bay in a 30-foot bow rider with a powerful inboard engine.
The V-shaped hull cut through the swells as they followed a heading that took them out to sea and away from the darkened island. There had been no time to order up the usual high-tech gear from Numa's quartermaster,